Hi, everybody. Welcome to Who Cares About the Rock Hall, a podcast about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm your host, Joe Quazala. I know entirely too much about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I get the sense that that's why you're listening to this show. You come to me for that expertise that no one has, because why would they bother? With me, as always, is my co-host. She's the skeptic, the voice of the people, the little devil upon my shoulder, Kristen Studdard. Hey, Kristen.
And the real reason people come to the show.
Ooh, okay.
The voice of the people. To hear their voice heard, to hear their thoughts expounded upon.
You know, it's really, if we're to come down on it, it's probably the mixture.
I think so. It's our undeniable chemistry. Everybody's got a little bit of Joe and a little bit of Kristen in them.
That lightning in a bottle. Well, Kristen, we're in the thick of it, talking about artists on the ballot this year. Let's go ahead and bring in our guest. He is a journalist, a podcaster. He hosted a podcast called Striped. Let's bring in Sean Cannon. Hey, Sean.
Oh, I was waiting for the applause. I guess that's fine. It's no big deal. I'm not going to do the whole regalia. So excited to be here. I don't know if I get to be an angel or a demon. I like sitting on people's shoulders, so fingers crossed that
piggyback ride.
You'll fit right in. Well, thank you for joining us, Sean. And first things first, since you've never been on the show before, I want to get an idea. You know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is a peripheral institution for many, a confounding one, a confusing one. I'm curious what your reference level is for the institution of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I mean, I'm pretty familiar with it. You know, as a journalist, you have to kind of keep an eye on what's going on there, you know, track the stories. And also, as someone who just enjoys weird minutiae and trivia, I know a lot about the history of it, a lot about the folks in it. I don't watch it every year necessarily. I'll usually try and chime in for the highlights. So I guess I would say more than your average music fan, less than some of my music journalist friends who not only vote every year, but like obsess over it.
Mm.
Okay. Yes. I think that puts you in a good spot for this show. You know, you're not coming in blind, but you're not here to rival me, which I would get so mad.
There is no rivaling you, though. He just admitted that he doesn't go every year and that he only knows enough, not more than enough, not too much.
Right. Yeah, that's a good place to be in. Well, let's, Sean, to get to know you, why don't we go ahead and take a look at this year's ballot? And let's play Sean Cannon is a Rock Hall voter. If you got up to 5 spots on a ballot with this list of nominees, who would you pick?
Oh, so tough. Well, you know, I have to be a homer and say the White Stripes would be number 1 on the list. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Number 2, probably Joy Division.
Nice.
New Order. George Michael.
Good.
Number 3. Let's see here. Number 4, Iron Maiden. Ooh. And then Tribe Called Quest.
Okay.
Look, that's
possibly
a good ballot.
Rounding out the 5.
Eclectic.
Yeah.
I would say, which is, you know, a way you could describe this ballot as a whole. But yeah, we advocate for crossing the genre lines, you know, having a class that's diverse in sound and everything, really. And so I would say that's a good ballot right there.
Yeah, I like it. Was there anybody who was kind of like circling that number 5 position? Were you, was anybody else jockeying to take Tribe's spot as your number 5? I feel like that's usually the spot where people have their, you know, there's a couple of people, it could have gone a couple of ways, or were you sure?
It's tough, you know. I wouldn't mind having Willie Nelson in there, although I'm particularly weirded out by the inclusion of people who are playing both types of music, country and Western, being added into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. which seems odd because I have no problem with like hip hop artists or, you know, more pop oriented folks. So like Tribe, George Michael, those are fine for me. But Willie Nelson feels a little like an outlier. And maybe that's just because we're talking about a form of music that predates rock and roll, whereas rock and roll itself is like, I guess you could say like an always evolving thing. So maybe Willie Nelson, possibly.
I think that's an astute assessment about the issues surrounding country's involvement, you know, because when country has its own Hall of Fame, and that Hall of Fame was established in 1961 before the Beatles ever released a recording. So, you know, it absolutely predates, you know, kind of the rock and roll era. If they were already doing already establishing a Hall of Fame before the British invasion, you know, I think your point stands, and it's a strong one. But at the same rate, you know, we talked about Willie not long ago. He's a cross cultural figure. He bridges certain genres. So, you know, there's that to consider as well. The only thing really to think about is what's his induction going to look like, because he's 100%.
Yeah, he's definitely getting in. He doesn't need your vote. and it really doesn't matter whether we like it or anyone likes it or not. That guy is going
just happening.
In.
Just happening. He's got the legend slot. And that's, if you're going to put your money on somebody, you put it on the legend who is nearly 90 years old.
How old was Willie Nelson when the Country Hall of Fame started?
So if you think that's 60 years ago.
So he was like 30 years old when the Country Hall of Fame started.
Yeah.
He was 30 years old before the Beatles wrote released a record.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not quite 30, but close to it, like late 20s. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Something to think about.
He's been around.
Yeah. Can't say that. Can't say that he hasn't.
Anyway, I want to talk about the White Stripes. Let's transition to that and talk about your personal history with the group. And, you know, we can kind of start with, do you remember the first time you heard the White Stripes?
I can't say that I remember the first time. But what I do remember is the first time I saw the Fell in Love with a Girl video, because that was one of those paradigm shifting moments for me. And I feel like for a lot of other people, you know, it felt like maybe for a little while the music video as a form had kind of become a little stale.
Lost its
maybe
way.
Maybe that's because, maybe that's because it was dominated by a lot of like very sugary, like, top 40 pop stuff, and you know, there was a lot of Backstreet Boys and NSYNC happening, but it really felt like it heralded in this sort of new era of creativity with all of those you know, Michelle Gondry and Spike Jonze videos. I mean, they've been doing it before. It's not like they weren't around, but it did feel like an injection of creativity, which is, I guess, like one of the reasons why Pitchfork, who've not always been friendly to the White Stripes, did say it was, I think, the best music video of the aughts. So,
And for our listeners, it's all Lego.
It's Lego.
And it's, like you said, Michelle Gondry directed it. And it is, and it's not like it's Lego sculptures. It's almost like an overhead,
it's like
two-dimensional Lego animation.
Like pixelated because
almost,
of the blockiness of the Legos and stuff. It's a fun one.
You know, this is an artist that I can actually say that I remember when I first heard them, because I don't know, often the artists we cover did not like debut when I was paying attention to music, but this band definitely did. And they did a performance on the MTV Movie Awards. And I had never heard them before, and they were so different and so weird that like they caught my attention, and I wasn't sure exactly what to think of them at the time, because I was also relatively deep in my phase of like new music sucks, man.
Remember classic when, rock?
Yeah, exactly.
You were a boomer.
I was like a boomer.
You were 12, I was a 12-year-old boomer.
Yeah.
That's your memoir.
No, truly though, like I thought I was interesting by being like, old music was the best. You know, the stuff they put out now, it's just not the same, man.
No, I think every kid goes through that. Like when they discover the Beatles, they're like, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah, right. And so I liked the White Stripes, but I recall even being with friends watching the award show and being like, what's this? What do they think they're doing? Even though I was internally struggling with the fact that like,
you're like, oh, this rocks.
This rocks a lot. Yeah. Kristen, do you have any
I don't
early
remember
memories?
The first time I heard them or anything like that. When did they debut? The late 90s?
Early
2000s. Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing their... I remember like Seven Nation Army. I remember that music
and that
video.
Yeah. And that would have been later. You
and
would
that,
definitely have...
Like, baseline, but I knew Fell in Love with the Girl as well, yeah. And that music video as well. But I was not super into like quote unquote like alternative rock music at that point. I was more into like indie rock music, like
sure.
And they were almost like a little too, they were getting played on radio stations that I used to listen to, but that I had stopped listening to, and I was now just like trying to find Pavement singles on, you know, Napster or whatever.
That's interesting. So you must have like missed them in the crossover from being indie darlings to commercial rock heavyweights, because their first tour was with Pavement. They opened for Pavement 3 dates in the South in 99.
Yeah, no, I was like in the early aughts is when I started getting into like college radio indie rock music. And I was that same thing of like, I thought I was discovering everything for the first time. I'm like, this Neutral Milk Hotel is interesting. stuff. And no, I mean, I completely missed them.
It sounds you guys crossed over at like the exact same time. Like you went to indie just as they were kind of like leaving it.
Yeah. I also was embarrassingly into like pop punk music at this point too. I'm sure I was like really listening to, I'm trying to even remember what like record labels I was into. I was listening to like, you know, pop punk record label samplers and a lot of, you know, early 2000s Alkaline Trio and stuff.
A lot of drive-through records.
Yes, drive-through records for sure. Some Vagrant records. I was just out there doing music that I don't really listen to anymore either. Like that, I think, is an interesting thing. I only say
are
Pavement
you saying
because that's
you,
like the
you,
best you, part of my musical taste at that
hold
point.
On. Christian, are you saying somehow you grew out of pop punk?
Can you believe it?
Okay. It was whatever.
I flew high and I flew fast. And then I hit the ground.
But Sean, I want to talk about what leads you to doing a podcast about the White Stripes, Striped, as it's called.
You know, there was a little while where I was working at Discogs and became friendly with the Third Man Records folks. And it was right as the 20th anniversary of their first album was coming up. And Ben Blackwell, who's one of the three men of Third Man Records, Jack White's nephew, and also their first roadie, their unofficial archivist, you know, all kinds of stuff. He and I were talking about ways to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the first record, and the idea of a podcast came up. You know, I used to work in public radio, have a long history in podcasts, in audio in general. And, you know, he said, well, why the hell not? Let's do it. The irony being that, like, we had a month to get it done, and I was like, that's fine, whatever, I don't care. I don't have to sleep for the next 4 weeks. It's cool, no big deal. So, you know, we put the first season together. Ben and I did a lot of back and forth. You know, he really leads a lot of the story in terms of providing color, especially for the first 2 seasons, which are out, because he was around for most of it. I mean, he was essentially the annoying little kid saying like, hey, Uncle Jack, can I come on tour with you? And if he hears me say this, he'll probably begrudgingly agree because I don't think he likes to think of himself that way, but he knows it's true.
Sure.
So we just did the first season. Then we came back for the second season to cover the second record as we were approaching the 20th anniversary for Distill, their sophomore album. And as we were putting the finishing touches on that, the pandemic hit. So, you know, we kind of pressed pause, took a little bit of a break. They got busy dealing with this new world in which we live. I had a bunch of other projects too. The long story short, we're working on season three and beyond at the moment, but it's, slow going. It's a labor of love for everybody involved. And I can't wait to get it out, but, it's not necessarily coming in the next few weeks. I'll put it that way.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that because I enjoyed the podcast quite a bit. And after the second season, we're getting to the precipice of like when things really get crazy and when, you know, they hit that mainstream success. And it's like, you know, listen to that podcast. It's so fun. And it's such a build to like getting to that point that we all know. And, you know, Ben Blackwell is such a invaluable resource. The fact that like any band has an archivist, let alone an unofficial one, but someone that was just around and has kept like everything and knows so much and can recall so much about those early years when no one else was paying attention.
No one knew that this was going to be what it was. And he just had the foresight.
Or the memory.
There are notes. Jack is a copious note taker. And Blackwell also has plenty of notes from that era. So it's really interesting. You know, I'm not sure if anyone really thought, oh, yeah, you know, we're going to be huge. We're going to redefine rock music, be the last giant, great rock band that sort of harkens back to, you know, bygone eras. I don't know that anyone thought that. But I do think that everybody involved felt like it was something special and we should probably keep track, which, you know, is a very different thing. But it's great because that means you have all of these videotapes from like 99, 2000, 2001 of them performing in like tiny record stores and, you know, shitty bars where there are very few people. It's something that you don't see a lot of, especially from like that era when it's not people also who come from money. You know, it's one thing when, oh yeah, no big deal, I have $800 to go buy a camcorder and go hang out with my friends, and we all just have nothing better to do.
Our parents are bankrolling our lives, and there's just kind of like that. I feel like that is kind of a rich kid's, every band that comes from money has like one of their random friends also is their videographer or is their, you know what I mean? I feel like
they have a team before they have
nightlife
success.
Photographer or, videographer for their friend's band. That's kind of, you've got to have some stuff. Usually you've got to have a little bit of a cushion to make that happen, to make that your life.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that's interesting about, you know, the White Stripes and Jack White in particular is like, they didn't come from money. They, you know, Jack was, I think, one of, what was it, nine children, and they lived in Detroit at a time when Detroit was not great. So being able to do this in the same way that, you know, bands like the Ramones did it, where it's like, no one's expecting anything from you. You're coming from a place where people don't really care about, and all of a sudden you burst on the scene, and what you have to say is so different from what everybody else is saying because of that very particular perspective that you have. And now everything's changed. Now everything's different.
Right.
And that's like, it's a rare thing, you know, particularly when you think about what indie rock and what rock music, whatever you want to call it, just music in general has been for the last 30 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a place for the Nepo babies to play, as it were.
Yes.
If we're gonna get into that, which I'm not necessarily trying to make this all about class, but I do appreciate the fact that a story that Blackwell told me that we're working, you know, for this new season coming up here, the White Stripes were gonna sign with a major. You know, everybody wanted them. and they wanted a deal where they got to keep their masters. And that was very rare. And, you know, their attorney said, well, you know, if you guys are going to get a big check as an advance, this is probably the only money you're ever going to get, because that's how this usually works for bands. The label gives them money and then you never see any more money. Mm-hmm. And Jack said, well, I've been poor before. I can be poor again. I'm not in this to make money right now. I want to earn it. If my music doesn't make money, I don't want to make money off of it. And, you know, that was a really perceptive thing. And it was all predicated on the fact that, like, he'd been there before. You know, it wasn't about maintaining a certain lifestyle. It was just mm-hmm. about doing what he loved. It's rare, particularly back then, when you really could get a giant fucking paycheck from a record label who really wanted you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen so much anymore. You're not getting millions of dollars for a record deal these days if you're a rock band. Mm-hmm. But those days, you know, probably could have just told a label, told V2, told Warner, told whoever, yeah, here's how much we want, and they would have signed the check. Instead, they said, give us the records. That's what we want.
Mm-hmm.
Smart.
Prescient.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now they don't have to do Jack's version of anything.
Right. Right. Exactly. You know, it's funny that you said, Kristen, about having a cushion, because he didn't have a cushion, but he did make cushions to some degree. Because Jack was an upholsterer.
What have we done? Yes.
He was an upholsterer. And that was, you know, that was the gig, that was the thing he was doing as music was taking off. And then, you know, you talk about it in your podcast quite a bit, Sean.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, another one of those strange things. Like, I don't know if he thought it would be permanent or not, but, you know, Blackwell talks about how he sort of approached it the same way he approached music, like it was an art project. You know, his record label's called Third Man Records. The upholstery shop was called Third Man Upholstery. He's doing upholstery again these days. If you go, I think his Third Man Upholstery Instagram keeps you updated on all the couches and cushions and ottomans and other various and sundry projects he's working on for friends.
I heard he got way back into it when the pandemic started, and it was just like suddenly had a bunch of time and was like, well, I'll get back into upholstery, and he did a ton of that.
Yeah, and he was really good at it back then, so I guess maybe it's like a bicycle. You don't forget. It's easy to pick back up. I don't know, but everything I've seen on the Instagram looks pretty sweet, and I just keep waiting to get mine. You know, I'm just waiting for the surprise couch to show up on my doorstep.
Right.
That Jack made in black and yellow, so if he's listening now, maybe that's coming soon. I don't know. We'll see. No, you know, he's just like a guy with vision. And I think seeing that in those early days with Third Man Upholstery is true. There's another story from the podcast. I'm not just going to like tell you guys the whole podcast. I'll leave a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, listen so to the podcast, guys.
Yeah, get the real deal from the podcast, but we'll tease out some tasty morsels.
Yeah, and it, you know, Blackwell's telling this story about how Jack took inspiration from old watchmakers. They would make inscriptions for like the next person who would repair the watch, because, you know, some of these watches would last hundreds of years in terms of being passed down from generation to generation. So when he was doing upholstery, he would write messages on the furniture frame. And there was one, the last thing I think it was that he ever did, he dropped off to this old lady and they were driving there, and Blackwell said to Jack, looked over to me and he goes, man, I wrote some fucking poetry on that chair. And they looked for it, you know, after everything happened and the band got huge and they started the label. Like, I think Blackwell said he spent a couple of years like trying to find that chair and could not.
Wow.
So also, if you happen to be listening out there in Detroit and you know the chair that we're talking about, like, hit me up.
Yeah, and if you suspect your chair might be the chair, tear that thing up. Take a look inside. Try to find that poetry. You could be sitting on music history to some degree.
But I guess my point is, like, it really shows the kind of holistic approach he took to music and still does to this day. And it's like, why the White Stripes worked, because it wasn't just him saying, yeah, I want to make some music, I guess, or whatever, And maybe it should sound old, possibly. I don't know. You know, it's like
right.
from day one, the red, the white, the black, that was there. From day one, the idea of it being a duo meant something beyond just, I don't have any other friends, because that was not the case. He was in a bunch of other bands before starting the White Stripes.
Are we going to talk kind of about the like public persona that they had when they first kind of broke out? I'm sure at some point.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like that's, you know, thinking about, you know, as you're saying, there's a vision, there's, you know, it wasn't just guys in t-shirts and jeans the way a lot of bands were. Like when you look a certain way, you know, it draws attention, and Jack was very specific about that, not only the red, white, and black, but also the how to present him and Meg, who was his wife, but
sister.
Yeah,
excuse me. Yeah, it was his sister. Wink. But yeah, about how to present that in a way that almost like keeps the press. I mean, I don't think he was thinking about the press, but just like, it's an interesting idea. It's like, oh, this is my sister.
I think he was trying to be enigmatic. I think they were trying to like keep people guessing and, you know, kind of fuck with people.
I've also heard him talk about how it's, you actually get less judgment when it's your sister than if it's a relationship that people can speculate about, that they can be kind of tabloidy about. You know, if it's just like, this is my sister, then like all that goes away and they're more focused on the music than they would have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you know, the other thing too, like I think the idea of keeping people guessing is a big part of this, because, you know, I said earlier, like the last big rock band that harkens back to, you know, rock bands of previous generations, and you think of all the lore and legends and, you know, mystique and mythology of the Beatles or Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, whatever, you know, where you hear these stories, some of them obviously, you know, that are true, and then others people debate for generations, you know, decades and decades. Some of them were still like going back and forth on what, 50, 60 years later. And that doesn't happen as much anymore. Part of that is obviously because of the internet, and the White Stripes broke right before the internet changed everything, and then sort of rose to fame right as it was changing everything. But I think that the concerted effort to create this whole package where it, you know, raised more questions than it answered as a band really helped play into that, because it wasn't happening that much at that point. And then sort of kind of helped inspire some other folks. Like, I'm not sure if this is true, but I would guess that the Hives were probably inspired, at least in part, by the White Stripes, in terms of, you know, they had this fake Svengali manager character who was just played by a friend of theirs, you know, like who was supposed to be the guy that put the band together, Randy Fitzsimmons or something like that. I don't even remember.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all wore matching outfits.
Mm-hmm. Well, and their musical sound also.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. Of course.
Certainly.
But it's like this idea of putting together this story and having a really tight, sort of heavily art directed package as a band, where you're making things up, or if not making them up, at least like trying to lead the listener and lead the viewer down a rabbit hole of strangeness. I mean, I also think of like Andrew W.K., who almost certainly encouraged all of the questions about like, oh, is this the real guy or is it a fake guy?
Oh, yeah. You are like bringing up some like this is causing some I'm like bodily memories are being surfaced as you say. I'm like, Andrew W.K. Yes. Remember the Hives? Oh, my God.
Like, yeah. An era. Definitely
we
an
were
era
there. It happened. Is this it? Yeah. Wow.
Right. And, you know, I also did not know that Jack took Meg's last name, that White originated from Meg.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I thought that was interesting. Well, as we continue to talk about the White Stripes, you know, one of the things that's frustrating about the Rock Hall is that there's no set list of criteria that voters use. You know, it's not like it's time to vote for the Rock Hall. We judge them based on these set list of criteria, which can be frustrating because, like, how are you to know who to vote for when you have a ballot that is full of great, worthy artists? So what we're going to do is we're going to take a little bit of a break. When we come back, I have my own list of categories that I've devised that I think if you do well, you have a good chance at induction. So we will evaluate the White Stripes with that after a break. We'll be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We hope you had a nice break. We hope over your break, you got your liquids. However you got them,
whatever temperature they may be,
hot, cold, whatever you need.
I thought you meant in and out, like whether you needed them in or out, but yeah, whether hot or cold.
Yes.
That true. Do you need to get rid of liquids? Do you need to, you know, bring them into the body? It's no judgment. This is a judgment free zone. All right. So the White Stripes became surprise eligible for the Rock Hall this year because the hall shifted the calendar because of the pandemic, and a little late for that, but they decided to do it. And whereas we were assuming that 1997 debuts were going to be the newly eligible class this year, it's actually 97 and 98. We were not expecting it. There was no announcement about this. So when the White Stripes made the ballot for the first time this year, it was a major surprise. Obviously the first, appearance on a ballot, and you know, their first released recording was a 7-inch single in 1998, Let's Shake Hands. And you know, surprisingly, Jack White has never been involved in an induction ceremony before, which I think
he seems like he would. I mean, feel like it's probably not for the Hall's lack of trying. Mm-hmm. I would be shocked if they hadn't attempted to get him any time a guitar person.
Guitar guys who, Jack would have fit well as a tribute performer or as just a guest performer on a performance. But you know, as someone who more than almost anyone like signifies a return to rock is still alive, you'd think he would have been to the Rock Hall for a ceremony before, but not as far as I know. So let's jump into these categories. We're going to start with iconic / majorly recognizable songs, and we'll attempt to kind of start from the biggest ones and then work our way down. I think without a doubt the iconic
song bass starts going right now. Here we go as he's saying it.
the song that everybody knows, even if you don't even know that it's a White Stripes song, is 7-inch Nirvana.
And to your point about that, by the way, I just want to say there are people in this world who recite the bass line to the song and have no clue it's the White Stripes. They think it's called Jeremy Corbyn, which is in the UK for football games, they will just all the crowds will go, Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, wow.
There was a Guardian article that said they were talking about some other Labour politician. And it said, oh, yeah, the crowd at this game started chanting this other Labour politician's name in the style of, and they didn't say the White Stripes Seven Nation Army. They said Jeremy Corbyn.
In the style of the Jeremy Corbyn chant.
Yes. So that is how ubiquitous this song is. So ubiquitous that it is not, it's even worse or even more foundational than other jock jams like We Will Rock You. At least people know the name of that song.
Yeah. I mean, it has taken an interesting journey. You know, this was released in 2003. It was off of, you know, it was the follow-up to the breakout album. Elephant is what it is, the album that was on. It was a number one alt rock hit, and it is their most played song on the radio. It is their number one song on Spotify by a billion. it's a billion jump to the next one. It's 1.2 billion is how many streams it has. And then the next most played song doesn't even have 200 million. So, you know, this is without question, this is the anthemic. And it's like you said, Sean, it like almost doesn't even belong to the White Stripes anymore. The riff is just a thing people chant, and they don't even know where it came from, almost like it's a folk tale.
You know, I mean, now I'm thinking about it too, as far as like it being so ubiquitous, so well known, and such a like a pump up anthem, you know, mm-hmm. It like makes you feel like you could, you know, karate chop something or break, you know, you could lift up a car if needed, if this song was playing. It's got that kind of lose yourself vibe to it in a way. But and now I'm thinking about it, I'm like, are the White Stripes going to close the ceremony? I know that you think it'll be Willie, and it'll come, mm-hmm. It'll come around. We'll talk about this at the end of the episode, I know. But I guess I was just like, oh yeah, I guess there is something about like everybody knows that song and knows how to get down to it. I'm just like, where are you going to put the White Stripes, right? Second to last? I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah.
But to your point, I think Jack White can come out and play on a Willie song better than Willie can come out and play on a White Stripes song.
Yes. And also many, many people can duet on a Willie song, mm-hmm. as we've seen, versus
the alchemy
many.
Of yeah. The White Stripes is that it's just two of them. You know,
yes.
It doesn't lend itself to a big jam, to people coming out and all playing along. That almost goes against the whole like concept of the group and what works about that group.
You know, the funny thing about it, though, is that riff, I'm not going to say that Willie Nelson could easily guest on that song, but have you all ever heard the Oak Ridge Boys cover of Seven Nation Army?
No, I have not.
They're doing that riff vocally. Coming from my bones,
I feel like I would trust the Oak Ridge Boys. You know who I don't trust? Any college a cappella group, okay?
Oh,
and you know they've all done it.
I'm not YouTubing that.
No, they've done it. Don't do it. I don't want to know. The actual, the imagining of it is so annoying to me. Oh, no. But I'm interested. I'll check out the Oak Ridge Boys doing it, though. That
and
sounds
the thing
more
is,
fun to me.
It's not a cappella. There is a band backing them. So there's like piano and drums. The weird part is that the drums are incredibly, they're almost like a U2 level precise, which is, you know, the opposite of how Meg normally plays the drums. So it feels strange. I'm not sure if it's good, but I do love it.
A Seven Nation Army, like by a mile is their most recognizable song. And that was off of Elephant, which was their follow-up to not their first album, but like their major breakthrough album, White Blood Cells, which came out in 2001. And the, you know, big song I'd say off of that album is what I would put in the two slot here, which is Fell in Love with a Girl. For a lot of people, the song that introduced them to the world.
Including, I would say, probably all of us on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
was the first song that, I mean, I feel like it's the first song we all heard of theirs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is it what they played on the MTV Video Music Awards?
Yes.
Or the Movie Awards?
Yeah, it is. Totally. I mean, like, this was the, yeah, this was the breakthrough song. And it's like less than 2 minutes. So fast and punchy. And like, it just hits you like a train.
Take me away.
And Sean, like you said, the music video was iconic, and it was just kind of like a perfect storm, like landing strip for the White Stripes.
Oh yeah. I mean, I can't think of a better song really to blow up to, you know, as a band, because it's so punchy. The video's perfect. Yeah, it's, you know, so short, you're in and out, you want more, like everything about it is just right. And the fact that it was the one that hit when it did, it still boggles my mind to think about how big it became and how just massive they got on the back of it. Like, it's the kind of thing that just doesn't really seem to, again, doesn't seem to happen anymore with rock music, you know. Many artists can get huge with a single out of nowhere, with, you know, without a major label backing or whatever, because the single starts to pick up steam and, oh, all of a sudden now they're signed to a major label. Sure, that can happen. But it's so rare for a rock band to have that happen. I mean, right now, you know, you think of like Turnstile, which is the huge hardcore band that people are talking about. Oh, no, they might blow up soon. And it's like, sure, after 10 years. Not their, you know, like 3 years hanging around, 4 years hanging around, no hits, nobody knows who they are, and then boom, they're everywhere.
Right, 0 to 100. And then I would say another song that could potentially rival Fell in Love with a Girl for that two slot is Icky Thump. Was off their last studio album, off of the same name, 2000. And because that song was a bigger hit, went to number one on the alt rock songs chart, and is their highest charting song in the Hot 100. It went to number 26, and it's their only single that went platinum. And I do feel like it gets played quite a bit on the radio still.
I think, though, it is one of those songs that, like, it, like, Seven Nation Army and Fell in Love with a Girl, you hear the name of those songs and I can hear them immediately. And I'm like, Icky Thump, I'm sure I know that song. I know that I know it. And I know that the minute that the guitar started playing, I would be like, yep, I know this song. Would I be able to request it? To be like, you know, I'd really like to hear Icky Thump right now. I don't know.
Might be a generational thing, because we're talking about, you know, this was 2007.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like Icky Thump was just, it was huge, and it, like, it crossed over in a way. It's almost kind of unusual, because it's not like a particularly poppy song, you know. It's riff heavy, it's kind of weird. The song is called Icky Thump. It's almost like
that's the one that's like,
yes.
That one. Okay. Yeah. I know that song. I just wouldn't. That's my guess of what it is. But like, what are the words to it?
I said, we can thump, look at Vaughn, did a Vaughn life down in Mexico. Already got one hip lap, one hip lap. Back it up. Yeah, I know the words clearly.
Yeah. Okay. Just checking. Just making sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably could be number two on the list. It's certainly a solid three. I love the song, and I thought that it really demonstrated the fact that, like, had they not broken up, they weren't going anywhere. Like, they still had songs left, you know. It's not like some bands where you're, what would that have been? That's what, album six? You get that deep and the wells are dry.
Yeah, right. But it was, you know, still, they're still firing on all cylinders at that point.
Yeah. So I'm with you. I think it should be up there.
I have, you know, I have like what I think are the recognizable ones from here that we can kind of go through. Like, I would argue that maybe the next one is off white blood cells, and it's we're going to be friends.
I can tell that we are going to be friends.
Okay, that was it. Yeah, that was the one. Yeah. That was the one I would say would be top three. Because it wasn't as huge of a hit, but culturally,
it
is
just
like
it means something. It's like one you can hear still today, and that is recognizably a White Stripe song. Was it featured in a movie
trailer or something?
Dynamite. Okay, there we go.
The opening of Napoleon Dynamite. It's also the theme song to Conan O'Brien's podcast.
Well, there you go.
And so it just, even if it's not like a song that maybe gets a lot of radio play, it's in enough things that people watch or listen to.
And if you listen to that podcast every episode, you know, then you're getting
a weekly dose.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also been covered probably more than most of their songs, like famously, because I think Bright Eyes and Jack Johnson have covered it. And it was on a couple other movies and TV shows. So it's just like, it's been out there in the ether. It's around, you know, even if it wasn't a massive hit at the time. And honestly, I don't even remember what it did when it came out. You know, I'm not really sure.
I don't actually see it as being released as a single.
Well, and also this is the internet exists now.
Yes.
Like when like that's the time when the internet starts becoming more important than radio. Like where it's like the tide is turning.
But so, also if you think about like you just heard Fell in Love with a Girl, right? And this is like your introduction to the band, and then you hear this song, it is such a departure. It, you know, you had hard and fast and like crazy, and then you go to this soft, like pretty acoustic song. It shows their range immediately.
Yeah, and you know, then you also sort of, you become obsessed with them. Okay, cool, you get that record, you're like, oh wow, they have two more records. You get the other records and you say, wait a minute, this is a totally different band, because you hear those first couple that were way more garagey and, you know, way bluesier. Not that they ever lost the blues, the stomp blues influence, but you know, especially that first record. I mean, there's a reason why when they played, was it Kilborn was the first late night show they played? They did one original and one cover. And they, you know, did it as sort of a medley so that people would see. I think it was Southern Can Is Mine and Screwdriver, maybe.
Tuesday morning now, I gotta have somewhere to go. I call up Tommy now, I call him on the telephone.
I think that was the case, and it was just to show, like, here's what we're about. We're, you know, like, we have a wide range, and it is interesting, particularly when you see their evolution on White Blood Cells, where it becomes an even wider delta of, like, here's what we can do, here's who we are, here are the influences we're trying to show you.
Yeah, and I think they accomplished that quite well. If we're going through the rest of the songs, it's kind of splitting hairs about like what is more recognizable. So I just kind of want to go chronologically. And I will also admit that like I said, I was resistant, but I was also in the prime demographic for this band. So like some of the songs that I may think are like, oh yeah, those are recognizable, I might just be like, oh, I was a 16-year-old rock kid. And this music,
and
just,
this was like a very like an exciting new rock band when at a time when there were not a lot of that going on.
So that
because also
said,
this is the post garage revival as well. You know, the Strokes had come and they were like not really like.
Well, they were first, but this was I think considered part of the same movement, I would say.
Right, but I guess I think like they transcended it, I guess I what is what I mean. I feel like the White Stripes went on to become like a more ubiquitous culture. Like I just
like an
think
arena
of,
rock
like,
band almost.
An
yeah.
arena rock band, exactly. More so than like a an alternative, you know, rock band that kids know and you know, their parents have heard of or whatever. It becomes like, you know, fathers and sons can go to these shows together, mothers and daughters, everyone. Yeah. Rock is back. Thank you, Jack White.
I mean, honestly.
No, I mean, in many ways, I think that's one of those reasons why, without a doubt, I know that, again, I'm keep like getting to the end of the episode, but it's like one of the reasons that they will get in particular is because they are so important to the rock like genre
Yes. And that goes a long way. That goes a long way in the hall.
Yes.
All right. Let me go through these. I would say off of White Blood Cells, the opening track, Dead Leaves in the Dirty Ground. Is a song that made a dent on the radio and was the follow-up single to Fell in Love with a Girl. I feel like that's a song that you might hear it and you'd go, okay, yeah, this is a song I have heard before. Not getting quite the radio airplay of the others, but like I think an important one in the trajectory of their singles and their songs. And then the second biggest song off of Elephant after Seven Nation Army is Hardest Button to Button.
One where, again, you know the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
You hear the name of it, you know what it sounds like because you're singing it to yourself.
Mm-hmm. But maybe more important to it, similarly to Seven Nation Army, is like the opening, like what the rhythm of the beat and the riff are doing together, maybe supersede the lyrics itself.
And I would say, like, similar to Fell in Love with a Girl, the video is like equally iconic, where you have that strange sort of stop motion-y thing where they're going all over, I think it is in New York maybe, and then into the subway and all of that. Like, it's another perfect Michel Gondry joint.
Right. They're moving without moving, so it's like they're stationary, but with the way the film is cut, it looks like they're moving, but they're just playing their instruments as they're like almost like they're being pushed around like a toy or something. It's very very cool, you know. Like you said, classic Gondry. Their follow-up to Elephant was an album called Get Behind Me, Satan in 2005. And I would say Blue Orchid off of that album. Again, another strong riff. And this one charted on the Hot 100, went to 43. And this is their number 5 song on Spotify after We're Gonna Be Friends. So there's that. And then Get Behind Me, Satan also has the Denial twist on it, which went to number 5 on the Alt-Rock Songs chart. That a kiss is on the lips, come on, you got it all wrong, man. And if you think that our dance was all in the hips, so well, then do the twist. Might be getting into a place where people, unless they were like big Alt-Rock radio heads at that time, might not know, but that's a fun song. Also got to call out My Doorbell, I think, is just like a really catchy pop rock song. I'm thinking about my doorbell. When you gonna ring it? When you gonna ring it? Yeah, I'm thinking about my doorbell. When you gonna ring it? When you gonna ring it? Yeah, and that's what, if I had to say, like, what are the songs, if you're not a White Stripes fan necessarily, might you recognize? Those are the ones that I would throw out there. I'm sure there are people who are like, well, what about this? What about that?
No, I think that encompasses it pretty well. I mean, there are others that, you know, like if you're on the periphery or if you're a casual fan, you'll know. But if we're talking about like, you know, the random person in a parking lot who knows who the White Stripes are, if you play the songs, those are the ones that they will say, ooh, oh, yeah, that song. Oh, right, that song. Mm-hmm. And then they'll hum the riff to Seven Nation Army before you without you playing it at all.
Exactly. Let's talk about the next category, classic albums. Which of their albums are classics? So, you know, we talked about White Blood Cells and then Elephant. Let me just kind of review what the discography is. They have two albums before the big breakthrough. So they have a self-titled in 1999. They have De Still in 2000. And then White Blood Cells was the breakout in 2001. Even bigger was the follow-up Elephant in 2003, and then there was Get Behind Me, Satan in 2005, and then they finished their run with Icky Thump in 2007. Do you guys think, without looking, that the White Stripes have any albums on the Rolling Stone 500 list, which, worth pointing out, the first one came out 2003, smack dab in the middle of their run, and then they revised it in 2020?
If they do, I would say it's probably White Blood Cells and Elephant.
Yeah, I would say it would be white blood cells and or elephant. I'm going to guess that it's, they like to do first album is the thing. They like to do the big first album, but I
or
guess
like the breakthrough album.
Yeah, the breakthrough album. That's not meaning like the big first album, meaning the breakthrough album. They like to do the breakthrough album generally, but first, I don't know. Is Elephant on there?
So this list came out in November 2003, 7 months after Elephant came out.
Oh, okay. So then probably not.
And it was on the list.
Wow.
Same year as the list.
That is some Rolling Stones. That is some Rolling Stone stuff right there.
There's potentially some recency bias when something like that happens. Mm-hmm. 390 was where it was on the list. And then it is on the revised list as well, 449.
What about white blood cells then? Wait. So then I'm going to say that white blood cells is also on both.
White blood cells is only on the weird revised 2012 list when they
the minor tweak list.
Yes, they tinkered with the 2003 to like maybe incorporate some newer stuff, and it comes in at 497. They barely put it on that 2012 list. And then it is not on 03 or 2020. Kind of interesting. But I really think that speaks to their strength in the next category, critical acclaim. I mean, the fact that they had an album that came out the same year as this list of the all-time greatest classics, and they put it on there. It was a 5-star review from Rolling Stone for Elephant. And I mean, NME, Pitchfork, Spin, Consequence of Sound.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, but what did Pitchfork think? This is the aughts. What did Pitchfork think?
They are, there are many outlets that consistently rank their songs and albums as among the best of the 2000s and beyond. After White Blood Cells came out, the Daily Mirror called them the best band since the Sex Pistols.
I buy it. People love rock and roll music, and this was like decidedly rock and roll. People were just happy to have some guitar forward music be like undeniably popular and good. You know, you don't get that very often. Guitar forward music has just kind of like not been that's not the story of this century.
Ironically, it started out as the story of the century, but hasn't been for a while. I mean, yeah, that's cool and all, but really they should have 6 albums on the top 500. Let's be real. Come on. I have to say that. I know that those two are their essential records, but I genuinely think that like the first two records don't get enough love because people just don't know they exist, and they're really fucking good.
But yeah, I mean, like with critical acclaim, like they just were darlings. And I remember Elephant getting a 5-star review in Rolling Stone, and just like this was a band that almost made critics feel like there was hope again. Like the response to it just was overwhelming. Such critical darlings. But, you know, does that matter if you don't have the next category, commercial success? And, you know, there's nothing quite like the bigger names on the ballot this year, like, not putting up George Michael numbers. But it's also like this isn't Velvet Underground numbers. White Blood Cells and Elephant both went platinum. Icky Thump and a live album called Under the Great Northern Lights went gold. And, you know, the Icky Thump single went platinum. So, you know, they were commercially successful. It's, you know, they're not Mariah Carey, but like, especially like,
but she hasn't been nominated.
Beat it, Carrie.
You know what in the damn hell's going on there? That's for a different episode. But they're a successful stadium rock band. They are the great savior, the great,
and like against all odds,
hope of rock and roll, if you will.
Because the addendum to that, Kristen, though, is like, it's not cool if that's what you set out to do. You set out to be a great stadium rock band. It like when it happens almost incidentally is like, ooh, that is the coolest thing for like a rock people, where it's like,
it's,
they were just
it's
doing
like
their thing.
They are much they are much too cool and good to be as popular as they are. And I think that's what kind of makes people like me less interested in them and I'm serious. Like, I'm like, not that I'm like, oh, the White Stripes, I recognize that they are very good. But I'm like, man, they are so popular. It's like, I don't know if I can get into that, you know? And that's just me. Yeah. I'm a snob, and sure, that's okay.
That's the word.
That's what's happening here. And I recognize it. I acknowledge my own bias, but I also recognize that they rock and are very, very skilled, talented, fun, good musicians who write good, fun, interesting songs that feature guitar very heavily, which is something that we are just like not, we don't get our fix of as much these days.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I made a comment about how Pitchfork didn't always treat them that well. I mean, obviously when they blew up, everybody was on them, but it eventually became a little passe. Oh yeah, sure, this horribly successful arena rock band. Oh God, we have to listen to them again. It's like, yeah, because they keep putting out good records. Duh. But that's the other thing too, is it's like, you know, when talking about commercial success, there are the records and how they sold, but yeah, there's the fact that like they were a huge, gigantic live band playing massive shows to so many people. And that is something that you almost forget, in the sense that other bands from that era and before who are still around, still touring, like, you know how big they were because they still are. Even if the records aren't selling. But with the White Stripes going away, it's like it's a little bit different because Jack's doing his own thing, something, you know, that is like familiar but still markedly different from what he was doing then, and not content to just go and sell out arenas playing White Stripes songs, which is what other people like him would do. So I do think we sometimes forget just how big they were culturally when it comes to like that level of commercial success from a live perspective.
Yeah. And a fun thing I learned on your podcast is that often not using a set list, which is something that a two-piece can get away with because Jack can kind of decide what he wants to do. And Meg was very skilled at being able to follow him and pick up what he was laying down.
Yeah. And that's also one of the things that I think made them just a compelling band to see live, especially when you would watch them making eye contact. It was so different than if you just see two members of any other band looking at one another, because it really felt like there was some bizarre psychic connection. I'm just going back and looking at some of the footage. Well, it's wild.
And I mean, what's interesting, I mean, I say this as someone who just has the Wikipedia page open and whatnot, but like that, you know, they were divorced, like by the time they really hit the mainstream success and like big kind of portion of their career. And clearly they were still close and making that work.
Fake news.
Could still have a musical connection.
Fake news. They're brother and sister. Fake news.
Toe the line, Sean. Let's go to the next category, longevity. You know, even though they debuted in 98, technically they don't hit big until 2002. Then the last album is 2007. And so we're talking about 6 or so years, which is not bad. You know, it's not, you know, there's a lot of bands in the Rock Hall where the longevity is the key, where it's like, wow, this band kept going for decades. That's not the case here, but I do think, you know, as we talk about like Jack White as a figure continues to loom large, you know, he was on SNL as of this recording like 2 weeks ago. So it's just, I feel like they, even though the kind of imperial phase of the band wasn't particularly long, I feel like it still resonates, especially with Jack.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about it too is it's like there are two types of longevity. One is like how long does the band last, and then other is how relevant is the music. And, you know, I still think to this day, I've told this story to some people before. Not long after I started working on the podcast, I was in Cincinnati driving around, and I'm just like thumbing through radio stations for some reason. It's something I never do because, you know, outside of public radio, I think all commercial radio is pretty much garbage. So I'm like going through, I find like a couple of different sort of alt rock or modern rock stations, whatever they are. And I hear four songs in a row that all sound like the White Stripes. And I don't mean like, oh, it's the Black Keys. I mean like the riffs sound like the White Stripes, the structure of the songs. They like, it is all very, very clearly heavily influenced by the White Stripes in a way that's like, it shows that their music has staying power. Not just that people are influenced by them, but that the music is relevant. Mm-hmm. That the sounds still matter. The sounds still mean something. And I feel like, you know, to your point, Jack White still around, still fucking rocking it, still kicking it. And then the music that he made 20, 25 years ago still sounds fresh in ways that, you know, other music does not.
Well, that transitions perfectly to the next category, which is influence. You know, and sometimes it can be hard to track that when you have an artist that's comparatively on the ballot newer. Like some of these artists can be like, oh, yeah, well, they were in the 80s, and then we can see in the decades. But, you know, this is, you know, a band that was peaking in the mid 2000s. But like you said, and you know, the Black Keys were brought up, but you can't ignore the similarities of here's another blues based riff rock duo. Mm-hmm. And you know, there, I mean, you mentioned, so I don't know if these songs that you heard, you were able to identify the artist, Sean, but you know, it's maybe more of just like a vibe.
Yeah, I think one of them was Cage the Elephant. The others I did not recognize because I, you know, I'm not an alt rock guy. So I wasn't sure, but I did hear them mention that one of them was Cage the Elephant. Also, you know, I live in Kentucky and Cage the Elephant, a Kentucky band. So like, that's the reason why I would have caught that one anyway. Yeah. I mean, I don't know who the other bands were. I just know that you still hear it. You still hear it. It is there.
Cage the Elephant, kind of a White Stripes reference, if you really think about it.
I didn't think about that. Good point. And I mean, you know, the other thing about influence, too, is, and this goes back to, this is one of those nebulous things about, okay, how do you judge this? Not just like, does the criteria include longevity, influence, sales, whatever, but like the influence of the individual members, because, you know, even beyond Jack's solo career as a musician, if he quit the White Stripes, or the White Stripes broke up rather, and then he just went and started Third Man Records, he still would be one of the most influential figures in music of the last 20 years, because Third Man and what he's done for like vinyl culture, it's not like he single-handedly caused the vinyl revival, but
yeah, Urban Outfitters did that, so let's give credit where credit is due.
But I don't know if it happens as quickly. I don't know if it happens in the same way, and I don't know if it reaches the same heights without him. So that, you know, that's a level of influence that I think is like really important to denote, even if I don't know whether Rock Hall voters would factor that in. Some may.
That's exactly it. Some may, like we said, there's no criteria, so they can kind of do whatever the heck they want. They can be like, oh, I ran into that guy the other day. He seemed nice. Like, you know, it can truly be anything, frustratingly so. But let's talk about the next category, artistry/skill. We've kind of been touching on that the whole episode, but like, even if you're just thinking about Jack as a great, innovative guitar player, you know, maybe even at the, I would say definitely probably at the guitar god status. And, you know, someone, he's also has a distinctive voice and he's a great songwriter. And, you know, authentic is the word that I keep thinking of. But also, I mean, that everybody kind of knows that. But let's also not discount Meg, whose drumming style, I think, perfectly meshed with Jack.
Yeah, that's a thing that I'm so happy. It's sort of like, you know, for decades, people were like, ugh, Ringo, a horrible drummer. And eventually came around like, oh, no, he wasn't a horrible drummer. Just because Paul was doing drums here and there for this, that, or the other doesn't mean he was a bad drummer. In fact, if it weren't for his drums, many of the Beatles records would not be the same and would not be as good. Similarly, Meg White, got a lot of shit. And I think most of it, to be frank, was misogyny. I mean, she was never a clinician. She's never Buddy Rich. But, like, that was not supposed to be the point. That was, you know, that's kind of totally irrelevant. And I'm glad that folks have come back around to recognize that the style of drums that she played, the way that she was able to match Jack's energy in a way that was complimentary, not just because she was playing with him, but complimentary in the sense that she was doing something different than he was. You know, they were playing very primitive music, but the way she was modeling how she played the drums was different than the way Jack was modeling how he was playing the guitar. It's the kind of thing that maybe shouldn't have worked, but it did. You know, because like you said, he's a guitar god level. Like, definitely. It might get loud, you know, displays that, if for no other reason than the fact that they're like, yeah, let's get three guitarists together. I like the three best ever. I don't know, Jimmy Page, The Edge, and Jack White. Sure, why not? Okay, that sounds good. But that's like only half the point. If you're playing like that with that level of virtuosity, and then you have the other person pounding on the drums in like a very rudimentary is not the word, but just again, like primal, visceral way, like the juxtaposition there is what makes it work. Anyone who says that she's a bad drummer, either they're a dude with a skullet or someone who doesn't actually know how to listen to music, because it's not about how precisely you hit the notes and how many notes you can play. It's about what you're trying to say and how you express that. And she...
It's a feeling, man. Yeah.
She was fucking great
at it. And I think that's a hallmark also of rock and roll, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is not full of the most skilled musicians. It's never been the point. That's exhibited, I think, quite well by the incredible drumming of Meg White. All right, guys, we've made our way to the final category, perhaps the most important category. Does my mom know who they are? And my mom does.
Yeah, my mom definitely knows who they are. I think my mom, I don't know if my mom has seen them in concert, but for sure she would. Like, my mom has seen the Black Keys in concert twice. Like, she would love to see the White Stripes. Yes. Like, my mom, this is very much right up her alley. My mom loves like blues music and guitar forward music. And so, this is absolutely, I'm sure my mom is probably a bigger White Stripes fan than I am, which again is probably has something to do with why I'm like, I think they're good. I like them, but I'm not like a big fan, you know, like
you're rebelling against your mom.
Against my mom.
Wow. We figured it out.
But she definitely, my mom would absolutely, she probably owns their CDs.
Sean,
my mom,
does your mom know who they are?
She knows the name of the band because she knows that I work with their label. As an example, I had a syndicated public radio show where I interviewed a lot of people. My mom would tell folks like, oh yeah, he interviews famous people. And when she would ask me, who do you interview so I can give them names? I would say, Elijah Wood. No, don't know who that is. Ethan Hawke. No, don't know who that is. John Carpenter. No, okay. The Zombies. No, all right.
Okay,
Henry Rollins. Of course, you don't know who that is, Mom. Why am I even asking? I would go on a list, you know, 20, 30 people, and my mom was just clueless. And I still to this day remember one of the last interviews I did on that show. It was Weird Al. And I was like, oh, hey, Mom, I interviewed Weird Al. Oh, wow, you really do interview famous people. Like, all these years, she thought I was lying to her. Like, it's, you know, because it was such a different point of reference. And my point is, if you're not Weird Al level famous, my mom does not know who you are.
Not happening.
So while she knows
So Weird Al over White Stripes.
Yeah, who, by the way, are friends. So they're, you know, like Weird Al, one of my favorite Weird Al, not parodies, but style parodies, is the White Stripes style song he did, CNR. It's all about Charles Nelson Reilly.
Charles Nelson Reilly was a mighty man, the kind of man you'd never disrespect. He stood 8 foot tall, wore glasses, and he had a third nipple on the back of his neck.
Great song.
Right.
Fucking amazing song.
Very funny.
But yes, so I have an atypical situation here where my mom probably doesn't know most people who are even nominated this year. So
fair. An anomaly, an outlier.
Very much so.
Let's go to our verdict now. Let's make our decree. Should the White Stripes be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Will they get in? Will it be this year? We'll start with you, Kristen.
Should they? Yes. Will they? Yes. Will it be this year? Without a doubt.
Okay,
it's,
great.
It's happening. I mean, for all the reasons that I said before, it's happening. Yeah. It's just like they are the Foo Fighters of this year, except that I like them a lot more. And
it's the keeping rock alive thing.
It's the keeping rock alive slot. It's the everybody who's in the industry is going to just be bending over themselves, running to the ballot box to vote for the White Stripes.
Right.
It's happening. Sean,
what do you think?
Yeah, they deserve it. They will eventually get in. I'm on the fence about whether it'll be this year. I think it will be, but I guess it just depends on like how voters end up leaning as far as the level of eclecticism that they want to dive into, because I could totally see Sheryl Crow and Missy Elliott. And, you know, especially given everything that's happened with Tribe over the last few years and Willie Nelson. And then it's like, ooh, okay, well, then how many more? Oh, boy, that's when you start to split the rock votes. You know, I could see something like that happening. But I don't know that it will. I think they'll get in this year. I'm just trying to, like, really game it out now, particularly, like, knowing folks who do vote every year and how they think about all this stuff. So I'm a yes, probably.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, that's the thing is like there are with this ballot in particular, there are probably 9 artists that have a strong chance of getting in. And that means there's going to be some artists that get snubbed and we don't know what kind of snub it's going to be. But I will say, the Hall loves to induct a newly eligible rock band, which is getting to what Kristen was saying about the Foo Fighters, Green Day, Pearl Jam, Nirvana. The White Stripes is kind of one of the last chances they get to do that, to put in a like unequivocally rock and roll band into the Rock Hall and do it as soon as they are eligible. They hit all the boxes. Jack White is, you know, beloved by the industry and continues to be a very famous and interesting,
prolific.
He's
involved in so many different projects with so many different, you know, styles of music, but it all kind of revolves around the guitar, which again is in the like graphic for the rock.
So I would say put your money on the White Stripes. You know, Stranger Things have happened. You know, Radiohead didn't get on their first year of eligibility, but also they were very publicly blasé about the nomination, whereas I don't think Jack or Meg or anybody has gone so far as to be like, I'm booking a date on the same night of the induction ceremony and I won't be there, as Radiohead kind of did. So I think we can bet on it. Let's talk about what that induction looks like. Let's say they do get in. Who gives the speech to induct them? And I have someone who's at the top of the list, but I'm curious what you guys.
Now, is John Mayer and his guitar available?
Yeah, wouldn't that be confusing?
Yeah. I don't know who your top person is.
Shall I just go ahead? Conan O'Brien.
Oh yeah, that's easy. Right, of course.
Yeah, the Letterman type thing, and that'd be nice. That'd be good.
Conan met the White Stripes pre-fame when they were doing a remote in Detroit. met them at a bowling alley and they like hit it off. And he didn't even really quite remember it. But when the White Stripes did Late Night, Jack brought that up to him and was like, you were really nice to us. We had a really great time hanging out. And since then, you know, the White Stripes did a week long residency on Late Night, I think around the time of Elephant. They performed at the very final Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Jack offered, and Conan thought it was a joke, Jack offered to make the upholstery for the TBS Conan show. And Conan was like, ha ha ha. But he meant it. I listened to Jack on Conan's podcast recently, which again, the White Stripes did the theme for. They mm-hmm. like go to baseball games together. They're
they're friends. They're friends. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I just feel like, I'm trying to think about who else it could be. It would just be very funny also if Conan inducted the White Stripes and Letterman inducted Zevon in the same year.
Yeah. Oh.
Because that, I mean, he's probably my number one choice for Zevon as well. But there's more people for Zevon. But yeah, I'm just curious, like, what, who else do we think could realistically do the White Stripes as an inductor?
I can't think of anybody. That's too good of an answer. I think personally, hard for me to say someone who would make more sense, who has the same level of influence and impact that they do, you know, where it wouldn't be a step down. I mean, you could say mm-hmm. any like well-known legendary guitarist just for the sake of
I'm like
that legacy. But
what kind of, like, you know, it's like how they got a Beatle to induct the
Foo Fighters,
like, who,
well, you know who would have been actually a great choice was Loretta Lynn, because she worked with Jack White quite a bit, but she passed away, you know, not a year ago. You know, I had read that Robert Plant wants to work with Jack White. I don't know much more about that. I think Dylan and I mean, that would be insane if Bob Dylan, who I don't think would induct anybody, but, you know, I think he has some sort of a relationship with Jack White. And one that's a kind of, and it's something that I know from your podcast, which is that Sleater Kinney really liked the White Stripes and took them on tour pre-fame. And so, you know,
another band. See, it's like so funny that I never really.
Another band you were really into that they took on tour, like Pavement. But, you know, their most famous member is Carrie Brownstein. I mean, it's not like a huge marquee name, but it could make sense. All right. So what three songs do they play at the ceremony? If I'm just going based on like the songs that we picked as like the three most recognizable, you start off with Fell in Love with a Girl, you do Icky Thump, then you close on Seven Nation Army.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably accurate, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did something a little more obscure.
Sure.
Mainly because it seems like the kind of move Jack would do. So I could see Fell in Love with a Girl, Seven Nation Army, and you do have to close with Seven Nation Army. But, you know, I could see almost doing one of the songs that's like, maybe, you know, Death Letter or something like that. Something that is a real serious nod to the old bluesmen that got Jack inspired to like play the guitar and also do what the White Stripes did.
I got a letter this morning. What do you reckon it read?
I don't know what song that would be. Maybe Death Letter would be the one. Maybe Southern Can.
So ain't no use in bringing no jive to me. Southern Can is mine in the morning.
Something like that would not surprise me if it happened.
Or even like an interlude with that. I think that's something that we see a fair amount of, which is that they're playing one song, they do an interlude of something else, and then come back and finish up that song. I think that could really, something like that could happen, and just kind of like to demonstrate some virtuosity and things like that.
Also, their songs are short.
Yep.
You know, so like if they're allotted 8 minutes.
And they're going to be allotted, exactly. Their stuff isn't going to get cut.
No.
You know, it's going to be the Eminem also of it all, even if it's...
Yeah, your exciting newer artist gets more time. But also, they don't need more time because, like I said, the songs are short. They can fit a lot into the allotted time. But yeah, Seven Nation Army, you close with. You have the whole Barclays Center chanting.
You invite the Oak Ridge Boys out. They do the whole thing.
Thank you.
Well, they're there for Willie already. They're all hanging out.
Good Lord. Okay, if they get inducted, do you think Meg would go and be involved?
This is a great question.
I think, given what this is and what it represents, probably. You know, I think she probably would. You know, I know she really likes to...
Do you think she'll perform, too?
That's the thing I don't know. You know, she really likes to stay out of the spotlight. I know that. I'm like 75% that she's there, and maybe like 35% that she plays.
Yeah, I think the hall would do, by any means necessary, try to get her to perform, because that's huge for them to have a White Stripes reunion. And if there was a White Stripes reunion... ceremonies in New York this year, would you go, Sean?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I would go.
Because it's like, when is that going to happen again, right?
Yeah, that could also be, I keep referencing, I'm like, it's the Eminem of it all, it's the Foo Fighters of it all, and this could mean it's the Pearl Jam of it all, which is that like White Stripes fans could really flood the zone as far as tickets are concerned.
Potentially.
I mean, I could also see it being particularly weird and being the Nirvana of it all. Where you end up with a lot of other people, you know, instead of fronting the band, you end up with a lot of other people on drums, and they're ridiculously famous people as well, or something along those lines. I could see it going either way.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine likely... I mean, I'm like, she kind of, you know, gave it up to, you know, because... of the anxiety and also just not wanting to be a public person, from what I know. And I imagine it's like, yeah, a 30% chance that she would play. And so then in my head, I'm like, yeah, who are the drummers that they would kind of like rotate in on some of these songs?
Yeah, I don't know. Because on some level, it's almost like it doesn't feel like it would be about that. You just kind of have somebody, like whoever plays in the Jack White band, just have them... do it.
I think that's the boring version of it, though. I'd love to see like young female drummers in there and stuff, you know, like that's something I'd like to see. It would be disappointing if it was just whoever's in the Jack White band right now.
Fair enough. Well, if they reunite and you go, Sean, we will likely see you there, because we try to go every single year. So
yeah,
thank you for joining us, Sean. This was great. And I want to give you the opportunity to plug what you want, whether it's your social media or whether it's the podcast or whatever else you're working on right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a handful of things, but nothing that's going to be out anytime soon. Again, like season 3 of Striped, which will be coming. So please, please don't forget that it exists. I know it's been a little while since season 2 came out, but blame the pandemic on that. So yeah, just go listen to Striped if you haven't. Go listen to the White Stripes if you have for sure. If you're listening to this, you've listened to them. Go listen more. Go listen to Distill. Go listen to the self-titled record. Throw Big Three. I mean, just listen to the whole thing. Listen to the first record. Yeah. Listen to the second record.
Start at the beginning and don't stop until you get
to the end.
Yeah,
that's it. That's all. That's all there is to it. Anyway, thank you all for the chance to come on.
Well. Of course. And, you know, our listeners know they can follow us at Rock All Pod on Twitter and Instagram. RockAllPod@gmail.com is the email if you want Kristen to see your message. You need to designate the set somewhere in there. Otherwise, she doesn't want to see it. I'm not going to forward it. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. Rate and review us 5 stars only. Anything less than 5 would be rude. Thank you to Mike Lloyd for the logo. Thank you, Yusu Kim, for the music. And thank you to Pantheon Podcast for hosting us. I'm Joe Quazala.
I'm Kristen Studdard.
And who cares
about the Rock Hall?
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett. Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.